Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast spotlighting some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. Located at the base of Federal Hill, the American Visionary Art Museum showcases works by self-taught artists that empowered the singular voice of the individual. At the museum, which features a mosaic exterior crafted by youth at risk, you'll find pieces like the outdoor giant whirligig, a family of robots, and a huge sculpture of divine. In 1995, inspired by working with hospital patients with chronic mental illness, Rebecca Alban Hofberger founded the museum, and she still serves as its director and principal curator. Rebecca has led an exceedingly interesting life, and she talked about some of her teenage adventures, social justice as performance art, and why she doesn't like the term outsider art. Here's our conversation. What was your first introduction to art?
Oh, I think nature. My whole family was very, very close to nature. And I would have like wild birds that would even land on me. I mean, I had a lot of...
Like a Disney movie.
Yeah, like a Disney movie. You know, they didn't like dress me in little outfits or anything. But and just I was very fortunate with, you know, parents who loved nature so, so much and birds. And my father, up to his 100-and-a-half birthday, was able to, you know, call wild groundhogs that would come up to his porch, lumber up, and then he would feed them things that probably they shouldn't have eaten. And their little heads would, like, you know, furrow, and they'd sit upright when they eat, and they have, like, little raccoon hands, you know. So we were very keen observers. And to this day, when people ask me what's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and they think I'm going to answer in art. It's when I was a little girl, I saw a spider web in bright sunlight where there had been dewdrops, and then this freak kind of lowering of temperature happened, and it looked like diamonds on the spider web with the sun coming through it. And that still stays for me the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. So I think if you look for beauty in human action and you see it in nature, it's a marvelous preparation to appreciate truly great art. And of course, we would have every birthday at the legendary restaurant Hausner's, which I'm only so sad you miss. And it was, you know, floor to ceiling, horreur de vacui, they say, you know, fear of the void. You couldn't see wall. And it was, you know, just amazing sculptures and, you know, very classic and, a very opulent art from Europe, every square inch. Plus, she got strawberry cake, you know.
Like, yes, I've heard so much about the famous strawberry cake.
Yeah, you know, so that was a great influence. And then I loved going to the Baltimore Museum of Art, which was, you walked up the stairs, the main stairs in the old days before there was a wing. And right on the right was a gift shop. And there were, I remember, Egyptian mummy beads. And, really young when I started going and, like, loving that, you know, and loving the cone collection because they had it set up where it was like the cone house. You know, the cone family were very generous and gave, like, you know, all this furniture and rugs and textiles and much more than just the famous cone collection. But they set it up like rooms, and you got to kind of fantasize, oh, you know, what that would be like to have lived with that and who they were and their tastes. And that was very cool for me. And then, you know, the Walters, you know, of course, mummies again. But I would do my homework. And we would go over to Washington and I'd sit at the Phillips and they let you have pencils and paper back then in the galleries. And I remember the boating party was my favorite as a kid. And right now I have Matt Seesaw, a great visionary artist, his version of that painting that's so amazing, you know. And then I got to meet Hunterwasser, who had survived the Holocaust and who did probably the most beautiful housing for the poor in Vienna ever. And he was a non-architect, I mean. And, Friedrich Hunterwasser, to meet him, I think it was 11. And I never looked my age. So, you know, I was convinced he was very smitten with me, and I was sure was with him. He was fascinating. And And then when I was about 12, I met Yanni Posnikoff in New York, who was a self-taught artist who had illustrated children's letters to God and children's letters to Santa Claus. And then if we think about outsider artists, the first one I ever met was this guy named Bumblebee, who was deaf and made kind of bumblebee-like sounds. And he would wear a big winter coat with big pockets, and he had scissors, and he was a paper cutter artist. And everybody would pick him up, you know, in the summer if he would hitchhike, because he was known to be not only, you know, not dangerous, but actually be able to ask your parents kind of like, what's her name, you know? And then he would cut your name and these intricate paper dolls. And then after you let him off, he'd stand by the side of the road, like smiling, this incredible smile with your name interspersed with all these intricate paper dolls. And I thought, did I imagine that, you know, because it was so fabulous. And it turns out the great Maryland artist, Joe Shepherd, his family would invite Bumblebee to have dinner, and they had decorated their walls in their dining room with all his paper cuts. So, you know, and actually John Waters met him too. And John Waters talks about Bumblebee, who would go to like Preakness Day, and people would, their parents would give him like a dollar mm-hmm. and to go up to Bumblebee and help him out, you know, and cut all these things, you know. So I think I was aware of being fascinated by adults who didn't negotiate life in traditional ways and yet had something really fabulous to offer humanity and people and little kids.
Did the adults in your life when you were young navigate life in traditional ways?
Yeah, I would say the thing, my dad was called the mayor of Stevenson because he was so loving, and he had kept a huge vegetable garden and would just like give, you know, everything comes ripe at the same time. Anybody who gardens realizes that you toil greatly. The reward is wonderful. But by the time your stuff comes in, everybody has tomatoes at that point, you know. Both parents, my mother had a great gift for telling original fairy tales. And she was a very shy woman and extremely loving. And so I really feel like I grew up with the Rolls Royce of families who were in tune to a life bigger than the struggle just to survive. They were not wealthy people, but they had a great sense of humor. They encouraged that. And they had such an appreciation for weather. You know, I still love snow. Is like my favorite thing because it's so calming to me. And it always held the promise that maybe you wouldn't have to go to school and you could, you know, watch the soaps with your mother and eat chicken noodle soup and, you know, stay home and Nestle's quick chocolate milk. And, you know, so each of us has to be, I think, in tune with what fed us, what made us creative. And I think that, you know, if you ask, I had this other kind of, you know, experience my parents took me up to the Philadelphia Museum where they had the human heart, the Franklin Institute, and you could walk through it and it would go bum, 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 bum. And it had this red glow and they told you, oh, you're walking through a model of the human heart. And it was like really great. And then like 30 years later, I went back and it was like a bad eighth grade project.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But you realize when you're a kid, it's like, oh my, you know, like it had all the things. It had like a bare wire with a red bulb in it and it wasn't anatomically correct. It was really horrible. But it made me understand the power of theater, you know, and what has the ability to bond with people in ways that carve the experience on the hearts of the people who are experiencing it. And that was great.
When you were young and, you know, describing these beautiful experiences like seeing the spider web,
yeah.
Were you cognizant of that at the time, or was
yes.
it only upon reflection that you were able to kind of see yeah. its impact on you?
No, I was really, I don't feel like I've evolved very much. I'm going to be 65 in September. And, you know, when I look back and I look at things I wrote, you know, I really feel like I'm kind of like the same person. I mean, that's probably not great. I should have evolved more, but I really did care about other people. I was very always, you know, a defender of the underdog. And I'm right now, I feel very justified. The Max Planck Institute has a cognition, you know, arm, as many of the research centers do. But they've come out with like 8 different kinds of intelligence. And they say, but the one that trumps everything is intuition. And years ago, I was part of a group that went to test with psychic ability, the Young Presidents Organization, a very right-brain group of people, you know, who are, you know, super achievers in the corporate world. And lo and behold, they hate the word intuition because it used to be paired with the word feminine, right? But business people value their gut. Well, same stuff, right? You know, and so we did these kind of traditional psychic tests. And to our amazement, frankly, they scored so high. You know, I mean, it was just like unbelievable scores. And they were, I think that successful people are constantly seeing opportunity. I think genius sees opportunity where the rest of us don't. They see relationship and connections that most of us just don't. But I think intuitive people are reading more of the input that is coming into them, processing it, throwing away junk, but being able to say, haha, this thing here might have real, like, you're a creative person. You wouldn't be doing your writing and your podcast and your, you know, your passionate view of living in a city that needs all the help it can get. And, you know, you're always filtering, oh my gosh, that's an incredible story. Why isn't anybody paying attention to this? You know, and that act of valuing is something I do think you can cultivate, but I think it's pretty hardwired. I think we've been, I always say I'm kind of an addict for fresh thought because it's so rare. There's so much canned conversation, particularly from people who have been poured through the same filter of academia. Like they're so aware of, of wanting approval that they maybe watch themselves what they say they value because they want approval. You know, and I kind of like with people who think their own thoughts and, you know, aren't filtering them so much through, oh, what is somebody else going to think? And then you hear things that you never, you know, like that are, oh my gosh, I love that so much. I never thought about that, you know, but visually I had gone through being really painful legs from a rheumatic fever, and it was so painful that I didn't know it was called getting out of my body, but the only way I could sleep at night, the pains in my legs were so bad, was that I knew there was a little bird's nest outside in the bushes, and I would like project myself out, and I would feel the warmth of the next, but the fresh air of the night, and I could go to sleep. And it was just like my own little game, you know. So I think a lot of us, if you can put people back in touch with the first time they were ever deeply moved. Whenever I work with other museum professionals, I always say, you know, what was your entree into wanting to be in the museum world? Like, what was it you saw that made you go, oh my gosh, you know? And it's a wonderful conversation to have about anything, you know? You know, like, what was the first, like, food that every bit of you went, oh my, I can't even believe those tastes, you know, or the taste of fruits and things, you know. To be an appreciator is akin to the track of being a lifelong learner. You know, there's two really, you know, nourish in ways that I think at best are never separated.
Your biography would certainly lead one to believe that you are a very intuitive person because it's very diverse. I would love to hear how a high schooler becomes recruited by a famous mime in France. Please give me that story.
Well, you can. I have a witness to it in that he was a young, kind of student teacher at the time, Michael Makarevich, who's like an endlessly young scamp. He's got to be, 6 years older than me. But he was at Towson State, and there was a summer program that was designed for kids from what was then called junior high in drama and a junior high teachers in the Baltimore County system who were not drama teachers. They were either in the English or history teachers in junior high school students. And they were taking this course with the idea of how could history and English teachers make their classroom come to life, their subjects, through drama technique. So that was the premise of this Towson program. So I went, and it was just a little day thing. You didn't stay overnight. And I saw Marcel Marceau's film In the Park. And there was an incredibly gifted teacher named Tony Montanaro, who was in charge of mime. And I don't have to tell you, I'm one of these people, I really don't like love mime. I don't like clowning mime. I had liked what Red Skelton did, but I love the more spiritual things that Marceau did. instead of the cute bip things. I loved his creation of the world was like, oh my gosh. And if you think I speak quickly now, I spoke like 5 times faster as a kid. And I used to be so frustrated that people couldn't just read my mind. It was like such a drag to have to speak, you know. So I was asked, and I did not look my age. This is called female trouble. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on the air. But, you know, I had my period a month before I was 9. I was my height at 10. I didn't ever look my age, really, you know. And so I looked older.
And you married young as well.
I married young. Yes. Everything was fast, you know. Also, because I was so politically active, and I got into accepted into college early. And instead, I got to, you know, this letter inviting me. This is before, you know, email or anything, right? That Marcel Marceau was opening up his international mime school, and would I be his first American apprentice? And how that happened was that Tony Montanaro filmed me doing Pygmalion in the summer, you know, program when I was 13. And sent it to Marceau, like, oh, here's somebody who, you know, went from a block of stone into being this, you know, character of Pygmalion. And I was like, oh, by then I was really tired of sitting behind a desk. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So I went with only one word of French, cotton candy, my favorite food, barba papa, my father's beard. You know, and I'd never been on an airplane, and I moved, you know, and I kind of guilted my parents. My mom was like, oh, we'll give you, you know, we'll let you have a car if you would just stay here, you know. And, you know, they were so supportive, and that, you know, it opened up a world. What I have to say in that ride, and I got ripped off at the airport. I remember I took a cab, and it was like a Mercedes cab. I should have realized that was probably not a great thing. And I know I didn't know the money. I had some money, you know, I think it was like the world's most, you know, expensive cab ride to this little address I had from, what is the actor's name? His last name is Rothman. He actually was in school with Meryl Streep, but he had been in his junior year abroad to this horrible little cheap hotel in the student quarters. So at least I had a place to know that I would go and indeed, you know, live. And I didn't stay there long because it was really, Allen Ginsberg had my room, and I don't think they cleaned it since he had had it. It was really bad. And it was right after Danny the Red. I mean, it was a great time. The 60s, I'm so happy that I got to live in the time I did, you know. And I wouldn't, because it was such an awakening. And I have to say, I am freaked out right now from, we were the first generation that, I think I was 7 years old when I heard the term total annihilation. I mean, you know, they would have us do these, you know, the drills, you've heard about this, you know, for nuclear war. And, you know, when you hear a siren, it can mean disaster and, you know, line up. And I think I started the childhood riot by saying, you know, but if it's really war, can we go home to our parents? You know, like, and everything.
Yeah, that would make sense.
You know, instead of like, who wants to be, you know, under our desk, you know.
With your like horrible fourth grade teacher.
You know, but it's really, I think we all grew up kind of praying there would never be nuclear war. And then we figured, oh, well, we're past that. And then it's very disturbing right now to hear people making that a viable possibility, you know, so I have to put that in. But what's your next question?
So after your miming experience, you went on to be a ballerina, right? And co-found a ballet company?
I co-founded a ballet. I was not a ballerina.
You were not yourself. Okay.
No. Mm-hmm. I took a lot of ballet, but that was not my great gift. To be a mime, we had tightrope walking. We had fencing. I mean, we had to control literally like every muscle of our bodies, you know. And this handsome young teacher that Marceau brought in was the star ballet dancer of the Paris Opera. And he was a choreographer and very serious. He was a classical pianist. And he was 27. I was 17 when I met him, I guess, when I was at the end of 16 and I turned 17. And he wanted to have a more spiritual ballet company. And so we came back for the birth of my first child, which was 4th of July at Sinai Hospital, you know. And I always knew how to put things together. You know, it's kind of Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, but he didn't speak English at that point. We only spoke French together. And Jim Rouse gave us the chance to have our own ballet company. And I called Emilio Pucci, the great designer, and got him to do our sets and costumes for free.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's just like, wow, you know. And it was an amazing time. And ultimately, for many reasons, after raising all these funds and opening and rehearsing, some funding fell through and it disbanded. But it gave me the talent of knowing how to create a nonprofit, have goals, how do you make it come off? And I became a consultant from that, and, you know, for nonprofits and to raise, you know, to have money, you know, to be able to have my daughter that we then separated. My first husband ran off with a beautiful California ballerina. And we maintain our friendship, et cetera. But I had the skill. And so I did. And my first love was always science. I always loved how things work. You know, like I always ask people who grew up in my era, you're an engineer or scientist or, you know, a creative person. Did you have Mexican jumping beans? And did you have to crack them open, like to figure out how they worked, you know? And like the kids who did that, you know, usually go on to be very creative. Mm-hmm. You know how even Einstein said, you know, it's not that I'm like so much smarter than everybody. I'm just more passionately curious. And being curious is why you do something so well. You know, it's that need to understand and pass it through the filter of your understanding, not just to know facts, you know.
Where did the idea for the American Visionary Art Museum come from?
It's wholly based on fresh thought and intuition. I was working for 5.5 years for the Department of Psychiatry at Sinai Hospital with people returning from, for the most part, long hospitalizations for chronic mental illness. And sometimes I would see such sensitivity from individuals amongst them and concern and wonderful, admirable adult traits, but they may not be so great at negotiating this reality in terms of, you know, job or whatever. We were helping with that. And I thought, oh, I hate labels, you know, because we've all known people who like went to Harvard, make a lot of money, play good tennis, look good, smell good, but may be very toxic to everyone around them. And yet they'll never get a diagnosis, you know, because they kind of play the game well. So I was very interested in expanding the definition of a human life, the worthwhile human life. And that's actually our number one of our 7 kind of award-winning, now, you know, like the Lower East Side Girls Club was founded on without changing one word on the 7 education goals that were our museum is founded on, that I wrote as fast as could come out of my hand. They're really beautiful. You know, they're about empowering the singular voice of the individual. So I then when I had the idea for the museum, everybody said, oh, well, there are, you know, there's the Museum of the Subconscious in Brazil. There's La Fabulosería, a small museum of outsider art in France, and another great one founded by Jean de Buffet when he was so tired of the commercial modern art scene that for inspiration, he collected the artwork of you know, like street people and mental patients and truck drivers and psychic mediums and, you know, factory workers. And he put these fabulous things that inspired him in a collection that had to do with his family business. You know, you've heard of Champagne Brut, raw champagne. He called it Art Brut Collection. And he didn't even want to use the word museum because he felt that had a bad institutional vibe, you know. C'est collection de la brute. And I went and made a film with my friend Donna Mattson and Leroy Kane because he was fascinated by German Expressionist art at that time. And we weren't married, but he was so moved by what he saw because the Expressionists love the outsider, you know. I don't like the term outsider very much, but visionary artists. And from then, I realized, oh, the beautiful bios that weren't museum-y. They were like talking people to people. And from then, I really got the idea of working thematically because I saw that the single most common theme of visionary artists was the recreation of the Garden of Eden or some utopia in their backyard. And they weren't trying to get into galleries. They were just, every morning, they had a reason to get up and work on this incredible patch of perfection that they could generate themselves. And I thought, oh, those are people we could learn a lot from. And so we opened with the Tree of Life. It began there. And I knew before we opened the door, the first 11 themes of the exhibition. And in fact, you know, we're going to turning 22 this November and Thanksgiving. And I have picked every theme since we've opened. And now I have such a great staff, and I have the most wonderful board of directors of the last 6 years. I tell you, they really get it. And in fact, the board of the Folk Art Museum from New York are all coming down this summer to learn kind of like what we've done and how we've done it. And I actually brought something today. The State Department brings us a lot of visitors, but the heads of the two Polish museums, they said, would I take them around? And I said, sure. And Da Vinci's Girl with an Ermine is like in the Warsaw collection. And this is the director there. And I said, oh, I can't believe you're bringing me this image of your catalog, you know, the most prized possession, because this is work by Margaret Muntz Loesch. And it's her version inspired from Da Vinci's work of her best friend's daughter who survived grand mal seizures and encephalitis with her little dog. But that's colored pencil. It's not a photograph.
Oh, wow. It looks like a photo.
Isn't that unbelievable? And so the head of the Warsaw Museum was like blown away too, you know. Right. So, I would never have done the museum if it was just a hip, cool place, frankly, because there's a lot of really great stuff around. But it's a very healing place. And the fact that we have used it to promote creative acts of social justice as the highest performance art. And I have to say one of the earliest benefactors was Damonita Roddick, the woman who founded the Body Shop. And, you know, people, male and female, I have to say, but, you know, who really have, like, realized they're not going to be, you know, nobody gets out alive from Earth, you know, and have woken up early to, you know, that they can use their life in some amazing, happy way to help others. Those are the people, for me, who I esteem. And that's why we've given Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Patch Adams awards, Pam Horowitz and her husband, Julian Bond. You know, why we valued Dean Kamen, the inventor. You know, we're hungry for people who are creative in looking at how they can take their talents and serve a greater good. And to me, that's the ultimate purpose for why we come through.
Why don't you like the term outsider art?
There was all this kind of masturbatory discussion early on in the outsider world. Ooh, if they've been shown and they go to their opening, are they no longer outsider? Are they now insiders? You know, it was like the circuitous stuff. And, you know, I think it was, we're all insiders in life. And everybody, no matter what how good their life looks like from the outside, everybody is struggling with something. I'm convinced of that, you know? And so I just thought like it was this artificial, a thing. And we've shown work, we say largely self-taught. I mean, I do get like RISD professors who say, oh, I'm a visionary, and their stuff looks like ripoffs of Rothko, you know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, really? You know, like, and so we're looking for an intuitive creation. My favorite artists, quite frankly, don't even maybe think of themselves as artists. You know, it's just one of the many ways that they're creative. And we try to have that value, that it's not my goal that people come to the museum and go, oh, now, ooh, I can see I could be an artist too. It's nice if that's really their path. I just want people to be empowered to do what they've come in to do really, really well. And that's actually the last of our 7 education goals at any age. You know, and sometimes the great thing is, you know, you work at a job, and a lot of times people catch fire in a good way when they're like, you know, 60 and more. They've had their life, they've done whether they're going to get married or not get married, whether they're going to have children or not. They've worked at jobs. They've seen kind of bad managers, good managers. You know, they've had a life experience. And what's great is when you get to a point where you don't care so much what other people think, and you're so in touch with what you want to do, that it comes out. That's something we really celebrate at the museum.
Besides being largely self-taught, how would you define visionary art for people who maybe haven't gone to the museum before?
Oh, well, they had to come because even in the field, you know, there was a lot of opposition when we started because, well, many, many reasons. But I've actually had people who are in the field of outsider art or visionary art who go to the outsider art fair, their dealers or whatever. And when they've come, some of them have burst into tears because they can't believe how amazing the museum is. It's you know, the bling walls. I always tell my kids, don't do anything for a good reason. You have to have 10,000 good reasons. So there's layers of good. So, you know, early on from the very beginning, we thought, well, you know, like the walls. I wanted to do the walls as an apprenticeship program with youth at risk. And it's the largest program for incarcerated kids, you know, ever, you know, in Mosaic Apprenticeship. And I realized doors slam on their face if they've had any record. They can't become a garbage man. They can't become a postal worker. So I knew that we were giving them not just kind of potchkey, you know, youth throw up stuff mosaic, but they were getting the fine skills to be able to do tiling, commercial tiling for the rest of their life. So, and they also get lifelong membership at the museum. And that's been so rewarding. So there's kind of like layers of good. Three of our staff came to us from the homeless shelter and been with us, you know, many, many years. So there's, and you wouldn't know who they are. And I like that. I like that there's alchemical human transformation that it takes. It's not just object-oriented or, oh, that's cool art, or, oh, I don't like that this week, you know, or that. You know, it's beyond that. It has to function as a living, breathing entity. And we, in fact, do over 100 weddings a year there. And thank God, I always joke for those horny brides because, you know, it keeps the lights on. But even if we had all the endowment, and that's the only piece that's missing, we owe nothing. It's all paid for. And quite some achievement if you think of how much wealthier, you know, many of the museums have been, the folk art museums, for sure in New York, and, you know, are back to where they were in 1961, having really kind of mismanaged through a series of bad calculations, really over $70 million, not just the $36 million they defaulted museum, you know, on. So we've had a shorter time, but we've bowled a lot of strikes, and there were many people that made that possible. And I was, you know, very fortunate to be married to Leroy, although he didn't give initial money at all for the museum. And the Zambel Krieger, who had very little interest in art. But his Bob Hiller was head of his foundation and saw enormous value in my idea for this museum and really fought for it. And we if they had not come up with a challenge grant early on of really several million, we wouldn't be where we are. But along the line, I remember I had to keep the negotiating priority on the site. I had to raise like $500,000 in 2 weeks. And it was Anita who said, I've only been dumbfounded, or she used the word gobsmacked, 3 times in my life. This is the fourth. What do you need? I said, I need $500,000 or I'm going to lose it. She said, well, I've just messed up and I did something, cost us a lot. My husband got mad and they made, you know, a lot of decisions together. She said, I want you to meet Gordon. And when I met Gordon, it happened to be in New Jersey at their headquarters there. We drove up, you know, and he loved it. And that's, you know, at any point we could have lost everything. And in fact, there were 2 museums that opened up within, you know, a year and a half of when we opened who had a lot more money. And they were open, I think, respectively, the Columbus Center and the City Life Museums, 7 months and 5 months. So here we are 22 years later. And thank you, Baltimore. And thank you, really, the world, because when Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, came, because his kid was unhappy, a goucher came to shore him up. He was coming like day after day. And he left a note. He said, I go to museums all over the world. This is the only one that ever brought me to tears. And that's how we ended up. I said, good, because I'm doing a show on authentic joy called What Makes Us Smile. And you have made more people laugh than any human being I've ever talked to with, you know, his creations. And I said, oh, you know, would you be a co-curator? And he was. Also, Archbishop Tutu wept when he came and saw how his words were used in our great show on character called Race, Class, and Gender, 3 things that contribute 0 to character, because being a schmuck is an equal opportunity for everybody. But it was a really profound show. And he was just, you know, luminous. So, I know your podcast is called Female Trouble, and I know it's centric to women, and I think that's great. But I feel like there are never enough good people to, you know, like I'm just hungry for people who kind of get why they're here. And I sure have like so many fabulous women friends, you know, like the foremost photographer of Africa became a very good friend. But it's really interesting when I talk to my international friends that I'm very close with, we tend to know the other people that touch our souls. It's really interesting. So, you know, it's really like 200 people around the world that are falling on the sword in some fabulous way to help others. And it's not that many because we kind of know each other. It's really, it's fascinating to me. And I try to bring as much of that, you know, here to Baltimore. And hopefully that people catch something that helps inspire them as things have inspired me in the past. And we'll go on to do far greater things.
I wanted to ask about that early criticism that you mentioned. That was largely around the fact that you do not have a formal art training, and some quote unquote art world people found the museum a little informal or had problems with its rejections of tradition.
Uh-huh.
How do you respond to that criticism? And do you still get it as much as you did in the early days?
No, it's really interesting. In fact, there were all sorts of reversals. I mean, there was a guy in the neighborhood. It was like a scene from Deliverance. Before I got the museum, I had to go around to the neighborhood groups and get petitions in support that we could even develop that site because it was, you know, city-owned land. And this one guy said, I showed him pictures of Vala Simpson's whirly gigs. And he stood up and said from the back of the community church, "We don't want your whirlies and your twirlies in our neighborhood." And I was like, oh my gosh.
That's a good Baltimore accent.
Yeah. And so but after it was up, he came and to his credit, he said, "My favorite piece of public art." You know, so a lot of times, there's a lot of people who misuse art as a weapon. You have to understand that. And they trade art like stocks, you know. In fact, there are people who have contemporary, particularly because that's where the big money is, collections where they get advised by the same dealers, and they'll have, you know, Richard Serra sculptures right outside their front door placed in almost the same position because somebody told them that's where it has to go. And, you know, it's really, you know, and they do it like a stock portfolio. Oh, to have a credible contemporary collection, you have to have, you know, a certain amount of Jackson Pollock and a certain amount of blah, blah, blah. And it's like stocks, you know? And so I've always loved people. And if you looked at what the Coen sisters collected, here they were nice Jewish girls and they had, you know, the like Santoses, you know, they loved the primitive art. And I if you look at the interior of Freud's house or the Coen house or Mark Twain, it could be a house you could walk in today, that what they appreciated from bits of nature, you know, the Cabinet of Wonders, origins of museum. So our biggest fan is probably the most respected classical art professor in the world, Professor Colin Eisler. And he actually has given a course up, taught in New York, as to why he thinks we're the single most important museum in America today. Would I say that? No. But that's how deeply it moved this man who is a Renaissance scholar. He felt like we were doing what museums were always meant to do. And the proof in that pudding is that now so many boards of museums and directors come just to see what we do and how we do it. And I have the best staff. And, you know, it connects with people on a deep level.
So people are getting on board with the vision.
Yeah, they really have. And there were some wonderful people early on. But there hadn't really been a new major for like at least 60 and in one case 90 years here in Baltimore when we came on board. The most of the thing was they were worried I would cut the economic pie. So I bent over backwards to bring in money from non-arts sources and from outside of the state so that they, you know, would be less threatened initially. Now all takers can come. We're looking for someone whose name starts with an A, that loves social justice, loves our visionary art museum, and will endow it for the $25 million, the naming opportunity. And I kind of hope your name is Aaron aardvark or something very close to that, Annie or something like, you know, or Abby with an A-B would be good.
So for all our podcast listeners with $25 million to spare.
Yeah. Well, come on down, you know. But it's been the most beautiful ride, and I'm so thankful to so many people and so many artists who were brave enough to share their stories. Sometimes their art is so private. Did you ever hear of the young woman, Julia Butterfly Hill, who is a gorgeous young woman? She spent 2 years and 8 days never once coming down from the top of a redwood tree to make sure it wasn't logged. And they tried, actually, the logging company tried to kill her. And when Bonnie Raitt got her Grammy, she dedicated it to you know, Julia. But Julia had a diary, because, you know, long days and nights, all seasons up in that tree where people would, like, you know, pulley up, you know, food to her and everything. And she actually won. She won protection of that area of priceless trees. But she had this diary that she would never let anybody show on an exhibit. And I wrote to her. And she said, the diary said, I want to go with Rebecca. That's what she said. You know, I could, and she's been, it was such a privilege, you know, to connect with people, not from the head decision. Oh, this is a popular thing right now. We will do this. There's a lot of aping in the museum world because they care so deeply for the respect of their peers. They, I think, sometimes don't stop to think, like, what does a human being need to feel awe? And I think that if writers wrote books formulaically on what's popular at the moment, what's the bestseller, and they do, they would never get to discover what's inside of them that needs saying, that hasn't been said and can't be said by anybody else.
Have there been any disadvantages to your lack of formal art training in the past?
Well, you know, what was interesting, you know, when we were making decisions on you know, how much live human guards versus electronic, I went and I asked the Walters at that time to give me their logbooks of the past 20 years of incidents, bad incidents, you know, that had occurred. So I'd know what kind of things go wrong, right? So I could protect. And I noticed that disproportionately, it was their own guards who didn't feel as esteemed a part of the staff, perhaps, at that time, and who, you know, wouldn't get to go to their grandmother's funeral because they had to work or whatever, and they would do little bad things. It was much more in-house, and that was a revelation. And I said, gee, well, I think it'd be better to have fewer, better-paid guards who really are respected as part of the, because they have more face-to-face time with the public. And a lot of times, these guards were so smart. They were in the galleries all the day and they'd absorbed much and they had favored pieces, but they weren't ever to, you know, allowed to kind of break from just doing security and share with people. So I looked at, like, what were the behaviors. So I think that, frankly, you know, the reason that CEOs can go from one company to a totally different kind of company, and you know, usually once you understand what are the goals to be achieved and how you want the culture to be, then if you've run anything, you can kind of run something else, you know? So, you know, and then and just like collection management and there's always more. I always see what's not done right, you know, but, you know, I'm always with people who only go by the book. I'm always amazed, you know, that they kind of, the things they mess up on are pretty equal opportunity to things that we've messed up on. And I was very furious. The only really bad article we ever got, she said we didn't have guards. I said, how can you say that? We have a third of my, you know, like payroll is guards, you know. She said, well, I didn't see them. Why wouldn't you have checked? I said, but people are lending us what's precious to them. How could you put that in major print, you know? So, you know, you have to get a thicker skin in general whenever you do something. And you have to remember that if you get criticism, which I think is a great gift, because the people who criticize you or you can read about it or hear about it or to your face, you have to know that there might be 10 other people thinking exactly that. So if they arm you with what their fear is for you or their negativity, you have a chance to say, well, you know, is that valid or is it invalid in some degree, or is it totally not valid? So that when you present your idea again, you go, on one hand, people may have fear, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, but this is what we have done, why that is not true or accurate. So I think intuition trumps a lot. And I don't want to be anti-academic. I think whatever way, you know, you, but that you can't make mechanical, intellectual decisions purely. When I found out that Frank Oppenheimer, who had the Exploratorium, I met the people who I love there. In fact, they had offered us a pier when they had to go from their traditional home to a whole new location. They have two piers, and they loved us so much they wanted us to take a whole pier. I mean, that, you know, we've had for more than 15 years, the West Coast has asked us, ooh, will you put a West Coast branch of our National Museum there? And I'd love to build the America's largest commercial straw bale building. I've seen it in my head. And that's what I would build because it's great in earthquakes. It's great, you know, insulator, et cetera. But when the Exploratorium, I had to go out there, to talk to them. And what was interesting was this young woman said, oh, I started out here at the front desk. Now I'm head of the film department. But I got to meet the founder of the Exploratorium. And when he just was like this old man, and he started, she didn't know who he was. And she needed the job to work in admissions. And he, you know, had the normal interview, and then he said, hey, do you know how to break rules? And she froze, and she thought, my God, what does he want me to say? And she said, yeah, I think so. He said, oh, good. He said, because no two people coming to us will ever be the same. And I want you to be able to see when in their eyes you can see they want to come, but they just don't have the money. And you have to find a way to not make them feel that you're like giving them charity. You have to, but I want you to be able to think on your feet and say, oh, today's family day. I can't believe it. I forgot. You know, oh, you all can cut in for 10, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when I heard that, it gives me chills to this day because Frank Oppenheimer, you know, in the business of being an institution, you never want to be just purely an institution. You have to remember you're serving human beings, whether you're doing it as a hospital. You have to think, well, what is good? Jim Rouse had the most beautiful saying that if a city isn't good for people, then it's not good for anything. You know, it doesn't matter whether you have the best tax breaks in America, you know, for corporations or whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, if the people are suffering on the ground, then everything else that you have done, you've forgotten the mission.
Do you consider yourself an outsider?
I don't know. I have great pity for people. I realized I have something that drives certain friends of mine totally crazy. If I'm concentrating, even if it's on like a stupid television show, and they interrupt and say something, I'm aware they're making sounds, and they can be right next to me, and I will have no idea what they're saying. But I had the same thing when I was little, and it may be like my little Athena is so wise, and she always says, I think you may be a little on the spectrum, Mom. Because like if I'm concentrating, even doing my homework, like my beautiful mom would come and say, you know, time for dinner, supper's on. And I would look up at her, and I would still be like in my thought of whatever essay I was trying to write in front of the television. And I would see her, and it would be like, wah, 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 wah. You know, like, and I would look, and it would be like an effort to break from my thought to hear the other person. And it wasn't instantaneous because I was really fully concentrated. And I've heard later from other people say, oh, no, that's not Rebecca. That's not bad. Many creative people have that kind. It's called, not cyclone. It has some word for it. There's even like a cognition term for it. But I can work very quickly. If you gave me right now like a worthwhile theme, I could develop it as we sat here into how I would develop that into an exhibition. And that's why I can stop. A lot of people ask for ideas. You know, I hate it when they do fundraising because that's like the hardest thing in the world. And people say, oh, you're so good at it. But I'm really not. I'm not that good at, you know, I think people are amazed at the amount of publicity we get. And that comes back that we just do the most beautiful job we possibly can. And then that takes care of itself. You know, people then say, ooh, like we're not out there. We've never like rigged our, you know, Yelp, whatever, because we're not that together. I'm not on even Facebook, you know, like I'm always praying for solar flares, except for like the nuclear bombs would probably launch, you know, without if the grid goes down. But, you know, I really would like a more peaceful, non-electronic life, you know. I see the advantages of it. I do email, but, you know, like, do I really want that for the rest of my life? And I think this whole dependence on password is going to be like the worst recipe for disaster, you know, because you know how kids move away, they go to California or whatever, and they have these like Sunday conversations with mom, like, how are you, honey? You know, it's like rote, but they don't know that mom may have gone around the bend, because like the niceties of life stay really late in a person's trajectory, or dad. And I'm always thinking, oh my gosh, there's going to be all these assets. Nobody's going to know where they are, where the password words are. It's going to be terrible, you know. So the big thing is laughter. I think laughter has been said to be a vacation. And I went like 15 years, you know, without like a day's real vacation until we hit 20. And then I took off and really walked. I went to Iceland by myself, like just walk and pray. And, you know, and there's still other things I would love to do. But we're all working see what that transition will look like. And I'm hoping some vastly creative, compassionate, intuitive human being will step into my place and take the museum even further. But it's been more successful than I could ever imagine. And to so many people, I'm so thankful.
How long do you see yourself directing the museum into the future?
That's something I'm working out with the museum now. They would like, my board would really like me to stay for as long as I would want. They've been incredible. And I've waited 30 years to write a play, a science play that I've seen every aspect of. And I've just, that will be very consuming. So I'm looking at how much time we will need in lead time to work backwards from there. And, you know, I'm sure before the end of this year, we will announce what our process is in that search. And that will probably be another, you know, year and a half or so of looking. But if I was hit, you know, by, you know, like a truck tonight coming out of here, I really feel I have a staff who so values what we have, and the board as well, that they would come up with somebody would manifest that was just exactly what is needed.
Rebecca, thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, I really like, I want to know more about you, like ice cream, you know, queen, coming from Ohio. We should go now and get some graters.
I would love nothing more. We can talk all the ice cream we want after we hang up our headphones here. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, darling. PT, she a dope girl,
dope girl. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Rebecca Alban Hofberger, founder of the American Visionary Art Museum. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find past episodes, including interviews with other museum directors and artists, on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. We're also at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble and on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week. Dope Girls!